Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Men in Black International, The Dead Don't Die, Late Night, and Shaft, as well as the older movies called Shaft, because there's three of them spanning 50 years. Things are going insane in Hollywood. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Frankenstein created woman. Oof, ain't that sexy. Now we can move on from here, because if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First of all these stories are kind of small little piddling stories. I decided to step back from the huge ones for a bit, and I want to talk about small little things that are happening that I think do make a difference in Hollywood. One of them is the question of whether Men in Black should change its name now that there's a woman in the series. And this is brought up actually in the movie, and I'll talk about the movie itself. I didn't want to mess this particular subject up with the review of the film because I think they're two totally different things. Now that Tessa Thompson is one of the faces on the poster and it's not just Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, there's a lot of question. Oh, should they change the name? And even Tessa Thompson has been asked in junkets, oh, well, what do you think? She's like, well, I'm okay with it now. But of course, they want to be more inclusive. Not everything is misogynistic BS, okay? Just because it says Men in Black, it's not like Men in Black were real people that existed as a job in the federal government that then suddenly had to open up their doors and have a diversity program there. Men in Black comes from ufology. If you don't know the history of it, because the movies are sort of leaked into the pop culture, these come from actual reports going, I think, all the way back to at least the 60s. They were popularized by the Mothman Prophecy, the original book. These are stories of these mysterious men that would show up. They'd always be in black suits. Sometimes they were even described as looking less than human or different than humans. But it was always guys in black suits. They didn't know if they were government agents or if they're sent from UFOs or whatever. These are, you can find many mentions of Men in Black in ufology and that sort of thing. Whether or not it's true, I'm not even getting into a discussion on whether these can be true creatures or government agents. They were an actual thing. So no, this was not a diversity program. They did not make sure they put out women in the Men in Black field for the conspiracy theorists back in the 70s and 80s. Also, there was a woman in the first movie. Yes, she was a side character, but eventually at the end of the first movie, she becomes an agent. So this is not something where suddenly like, oh, well, we need this 2019. It's not 1997 anymore. We have to be all inclusive. Shut up, people. Just let it, MIB. Does it have to be WIB? Did you not learn anything from Solo last year when suddenly the conversation about Solo wasn't, hey, this is a fun Star Wars movie. It became, is Lando a pansexual? And then suddenly that became the narration on opening weekend. And you had all these parents going, I don't want to have to discuss this with my kids. Whether or not it's right or wrong to discuss that with you, there are quite a lot of parents who said, I'm going to take my six-year-old. I don't want to talk about him having sex with his computer. So now you're going to have people who maybe want to go see the Men in Black movie and then go, oh my gosh, if this is going to be some big Me Too movement, I'm not going to want to see the movie. Just keep the name, people. Just don't be stupid. Another piece of news that's interesting is Black Christmas is getting remade again. If you recall, I think it was in 2004, 2005, they remade Black Christmas. It's a classic horror film from Bob Clark, the guy who actually did A Christmas Story, by the way, and Porky's. This was, I think in 1974, a classic kind of pre-slasher movie. The slasher genre hadn't started yet with Halloween, of course, in 1978, but there already were sort of killer things, you know, all the way going back to Psycho and Peeping Tom. And so this was a mad killer in the attic of the sorority house. They remade it and it was awful. It was awful. The R-rated remake was terrible. So now Blumhouse is going to be remaking it, which means it's probably going to have a PG-13 rating. So just deal with it now. And it's supposed to come out this Christmas. I mean, Blumhouse, you got to respect them. You know, even though they make some garbage about half the time, they are putting together the formula that propelled the horror movies of the 80s. They do small budgeted, short scheduled movies and they crank them out and they're very good at them. Even if they're terrible, they only cost $5 million to make. So it's money, easy to make money back. Like what Ma did. I mean, Ma was made for a pittance and it's already made tons of money back. I don't know. This may be garbage, but it can't be any worse than the first remake. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about really quick and take a note of is Dr. Sleep, which opens on November 8th.
You're magic, like me.
I only met two or three people like us. They died. When I was a kid, I bumped into these things. I don't know about magic. I always called it The Shining.
I, of course, like most people who are involved in film and especially horror movies, I love the original Shining. I think Stanley Kubrick's The Shining is brilliant. And in today's light, now, if you had made Dr. Sleep, I know Dr. Sleep, the book didn't come out until like 5 or 6 years ago, but had you make a sequel to The Shining back in like 1990, it would have been very different because The Shining meant something totally different. Now, after 3 decades, 4 decades of it being out, people have discovered it and rediscovered it and looked at some of the genius work that Kubrick did that he hid, that he didn't make a noise about. And so you end up with this movie, the original, The Shining, that has depth and has a lot to say. And it has this impossible geography and it's amazing and a riddle in itself that has nothing to do with the original book. So I think with The Shining, you can love the book and you can love the movie equally. Even though they're very, very different. I don't know how they're going to sort of reconcile Dr. Sleep, because of course King wrote it for a sequel to The Shining, but it also has to gel with the movie The Shining. And if you haven't read or watched The Shining in comparison, there's some pretty significant differences, especially at the ending. And it's even like things of who lives and who dies. So I'm curious to see how well this jives with the movie, and I haven't read the book, but I kind of want to go back and read the book to see how it mixes with the original Shining book. So I'm actually looking forward to this. This one looks like it's going to be a creepy little movie. The next one I want to talk about really quick is Frozen 2, which opens on November 22nd.
You must find the truth. Go north, across the enchanted lands, and into the unknown. But be careful. We have always feared Elsa's powers were too much for this world. Now we must hope. They are enough.
You know, when the first trailer for this came out, the teaser, there was nothing I could play on the radio. It was all visuals and music. This one actually has a little bit of narration. It doesn't give you any idea what the plot is, aside from the fact that Elsa's out there trying to stop some threat. She's an Avenger now, apparently. She's Frozone from The Incredibles. But this one actually looks like there's a story to it, and there's some heft to the story, and it's not just going to be a fairy tale, which is, in essence, what the first movie was. The first movie was something like a Sleeping Beauty or a Cinderella or a Snow White, that old classic old school Disney, but without the necessity of having Prince Charming involved. There is a semi-Prince Charming type character, but he is a side character just as much as the female love interest in any other movie from the 50s was a side character to the main plot. So I think this is still going to retain the girl power. It's about the girls doing something and trying to better their lives and save the village and save their landscape. But this looks like it's going to be a quite different movie. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm curious to see how they're going to interweave all the music to it, because you don't get any sense of where the singing comes in this trailer. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Shaft, and more Shaft.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Shaft. Which one am I going to talk about? There are three movies called Shaft. I mean, there's like three movies called Ben-Hur. They're all remakes. The problem with the Shaft movies is they're all essentially sequels, or at least exist within the same universe. You know, Richard Roundtree appears in all three movies as the character, the original John Shaft. What is it with Hollywood just refusing to rename the movies and giving them a... I mean, there was a period of time where they said, okay, it always has to have two after it. But there was a time when they say, okay, you can have it like Child's Play 2. And then they say, okay, well, let's do it as Bride of Chucky. We don't have to say Child's Play 4. But at least change them somewhat. It doesn't have to have a 2 next to it, but it can be, you know, something else. Like, you know, Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein. Back then, they didn't call them Frankenstein 2, Frankenstein 3 or anything. But when Halloween came out last year, it was Halloween, the sequel to Halloween. They're both named the same doggone movie. Or the movie The Thing, when they made the prequel to The Thing called The Thing. It makes no sense. Just give it a different name. Shaft Returns, or Shaft Takes On Whatever. I don't make the rules in Hollywood. Anyways, let's talk about Shaft really quickly. I'm going to burn through all three movies because I think they're interesting to talk about in their own right, mainly because they all took place and have been made many decades apart. The first Shaft from 1971, super cool detective John Shaft takes his no-nonsense crime fighting to the streets of Harlem to rescue a crime boss's kidnapped daughter.
Listen, Snow White, me and you going to tangle sooner or later. Why don't you stop playing with yourself, Willie?
Shaft's his name. Shaft's his game. The mob wanted Harlem back. They got Shaft up to here.
We can nail your tail for manslaughter on what we got on you right now.
Shaft. Hotter than Bond, cooler than Bullet. Rated R. If you want to see Shaft, ask your mama.
This is the one that started it all, and in a lot of ways, this started the blaxploitation movement. Along with Melvin Van Peebles' Sweet Sweetback's Badass song. That, I think, came out a couple months before Shaft, but it's not like one led to the other. They were both kind of made in the same time. And it really, honestly, in the 1970s, Black America needed John Shaft. They needed this because it gave them representation in movies. It was the first time a major motion picture from a major studio came out that had predominantly an African-American cast or a black cast. And people could see themselves in the cast, and they weren't just all either criminals or, I mean, it was a crime movie, but they weren't always just the criminals to the white heroes, and they weren't the victims to the white saviors or anything like that. There's the main characters, the good guys and the bad guys. It was all there. And I think that's very important for why the entire blaxploitation movie boom that happened. And Shaft is a major part of that. It's also interesting to look at it in the context of the day. I mean, it was, you know, super cool Shaft doing whatever he wanted to do. Sex machine to all the ladies. But the other thing that's interesting about this movie is there's one weird scene that just kind of stuck out to me. There's a scene where he goes into a bar and he pays the bartender like $20 so he can take over the bar and basically roll these two mafia guys who came over to watch his apartment across the street. And the bartender is very 1970s gay. I mean, he's very flamboyant. He's like, oh, and later on, he's like, the woman with the boobs wants to talk to you, Mr. Shaft. And as Shaft goes into the bar, the bartender grabs his butt. And Shaft doesn't care. And I thought that was a real interesting thing about black machismo from back from 1971. Shaft is so sexy that he just realizes everyone wants him. You know, women, gay men, he's okay with it. He's just like, whatever, I take what I want, but you can enjoy the view all you want. I thought that was a fascinating moment in the movie. Overall, Shaft is not a great movie when you really look at it from a filmmaking perspective. The original Shaft is kind of clunky and awkward at times, and it does fall into cliches, and it's kind of not very well edited or terribly constructively put together, but it's still, it was something that the culture needed at the time. I'm going to have to say that Shaft kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The next Shaft I want to talk about is Shaft from 2000. NYPD detective John Shaft quits the force to take down an affluent racist who killed a black man and has threatened witnesses of the crime.
What's my name?
Shaft!
Gone from this precinct.
What is wrong with you?
I'm out. I'm done. I'll get in my own
way. In a system where money can buy you freedom.
What about the waitress?
The waitress? She saw it, huh? So what'd you do? Threaten her?
No.
next day, I just started running. I've been running ever since.
You ain't even a pig no more.
You think that makes me less dangerous or more dangerous?
This was directed by John Singleton, rest in peace. And I thought this was a great update for the character of Shaft, because you put in Samuel L. Jackson, who is, if you're going to cast anyone as the new Shaft, it's going to be him, even though he's only 6 years younger than Richard Roundtree. And Richard Roundtree shows up in this one, and I thought it wasn't a remake. It's kind of a sequel of a different character. This one, where it is very much steeped in sort of that turn-of-the-century hipness that doesn't quite gel right now. And it was at a time between the 90s, where the movies were a little bit cheesy, to where they get gritty in the 2000s. And overall, it works. It's interesting to see a young Christian Bale as the bad guy, you know, before he really got well known doing other things like Batman and winning Academy Awards for things. So overall, this is a fun movie. Just like the first Shaft, it's kind of just fun to watch him play that archetype and that hero that Samuel Jackson fits in the shoes perfectly. Although it's about as awkward and not terribly as well constructed, similar to the original Shaft. I'm going to have to say that Shaft 2000 also kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The last Shaft movie that, of course, came out is the most recent one that's out this week. John Shaft Jr., a nerdy analyst for the FBI, joins forces with his old school father to go after a drug kingpin in Harlem.
Your son.
My son? Junior?
Yeah.
You know, they say that cat Shaft is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
Ignore him. He thinks he's a black James Bond.
That dude was real. He think it was me.
If you gonna pursue this investigation, I'm gonna have to babysit you.
Oh, look at here! How long has it been?
Never long enough. Please tell me that you did not get our son involved.
What is wrong with you?
Here's where things skip off the rails a little bit. This becomes not a movie about Shaft. It's less a Shaft movie and more of a goofy fish out of water comedy. Because they take old school Shaft, and he's cool as he was, but they make him overly misogynistic, and they almost play it for laughs, as out of the time period as he is. And granted, there's a huge difference between 1971 Shaft and 2019 Shaft. But what they do is they pair him with Jesse Usher, who has got roots in the Disney Channel and the crappy sequel to Independence Day, to be his son. He's this sensitive guy who drinks coconut water and understands how to use apps. And his dad's like, no, you got to go get the women. And it's played as a comedy. So it's directed by Tim Story. So you'd expect that. That guy is known for doing comedies in the past. I generally like his stuff. I just think this wasn't a Shaft movie. It'd be like if you had a James Bond movie where James Bond runs into his son and his son's like, no, you got to respect women. You can't kill so many people. And you're like, he's got a license to kill and he beds all the women he wants. And yeah, you don't want to live like that, but that's okay. This movie's Jesse Usher, whenever he's on screen, the movie kind of falls apart and becomes stupid. When either Samuel Jackson is Shaft or when Richard Roundtree finally shows up, that's when it kind of takes on some new life. But overall, the younger Shaft wears its infinity scarf like an albatross around its neck. And it's not a Shaft movie. And that's the thing I found most disappointing about it. So I'm actually going to have to say that the modern 2019 Shaft kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Men in Black International and The Dead Don't Die.
They say this cat Shaft is a bad mother. I'm talking about Shaft.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That is me, the sex machine for all the ladies. They say I'm a bad mother. Shut your mouth. As you can tell, I am the voice of urban America. Anyways, let's move on to the next film. After all that Shaft nonsense, let's talk about Men in Black International. A young woman tracks down the mysterious MIB agency to get a job, then is paired with a new partner to stop a weapon from getting into the wrong hands.
You are the best kept secret in the universe. And I found you.
Which makes me perfect for this job.
You really think a black suit is going to solve all your problems?
We are a rumor. Recognizable only as deja vu and dismissed just as quickly. Time to prove yourself, Agent M.
The Men in Black movies I've been sort of like okay with. I thought the first one was okay. I thought the second one was kind of stupid. And the third one, not really all that great. So really, sort of like Ghostbusters, it was really only the first movie that's any good. And even then, you know, the first movie came out in 1997. As I mentioned in the first segment, if you look at the history of Men in Black actually have a really eerie, creepy, disturbing, almost horror movie level context to them if you actually look at reports of them. And I always sort of was bummed that they made a Men in Black movie into this sort of whimsical satire type thing. And I get it. It's based on a comic book of the Men in Black, but I really wish they would do an authentic Men in Black movie, like an actual movie about people being threatened by these possibly from another world people who show up in black suits and act really weird and tell them to shut up about certain things. But of course, you know, you've got a whole franchise out there and they're trying to reboot the franchise. And I don't know. I have real mixed views of this because on one hand, it's good to jettison Will Smith out of this because part of it, he's getting a little old to play this role, you know, to play the young punk role that he'd played 20 years ago. But the other reason is the problem with a Will Smith movie is the movie's all about Will Smith. The biggest member of that cast is always Will Smith's ego. I don't care whether he's doing a drama or a comedy. It's always his ego that's in charge of the movie. The guy is a good actor and he's a great star, but he's not a generous actor. You know, take somebody like Stanley Tucci or Tim Blake Nelson. These are character actors who show up in a lot of movies and they're very generous. They allow other people to get the spotlight. Not Will Smith. Not Will Smith. If you're in a scene with Will Smith, and that's evidenced by the Aladdin movie. Aladdin's not about Aladdin, even. When you watch that movie that's out in the theaters now, it's about Will Smith. And so I'm kind of glad that they don't have him in this movie. And in that respect, Tessa Thompson, I think she does a great job. And I'm not a huge Tessa Thompson fan. I'm not like she can do no wrong kind of thing. I mean, I loved her in the Avengers movie. I thought she was great in Thor Ragnarok. I hated her in the Creed movies. I thought she was awful. And those, so, you know, I think she's good and bona fide and genuine in these movies. And she obviously has a great chemistry with Chris Hemsworth. I like the fact that they're trying to say, you know what? This is a franchise that can be more than about just this one guy being Will Smith. And let's tell it from a different angle. Let's tell it from a different Men in Black organization. Let's tell it from the one that's in the UK. And I think that's great. And putting people like Liam Neeson and Emma Thompson in is great. The cast is fantastic in this movie. And to be honest, you know, once you get the MacGuffin going and they get their chemistry, it's just a fun little movie. It's an action movie. You got all the battles and the shoot 'em up and the laser blasts and the spaceships and the cars that fly and all that cool stuff that make it a sci-fi movie. You, in a way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Aquaman from last Christmas in the sense that it's not a groundbreaking movie. It's not something that is going to change the face of the world. I don't even know if I'd say it's a must-see. You know, Aquaman, I wouldn't say that was necessarily a must-see, but it certainly was fun. You know, this lark romp of these characters going around the world trying to track down a MacGuffin to stop something from happening. And in that sense, I feel that Men in Black International does just that. I think Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson have great chemistry together. It's a funny movie. It's entertaining. I didn't feel like it went on too long. And yeah, it's predictable. And there's certain things that you see coming from a mile away. But then again, so do most of the movies. You watch enough movies, you become smarter than your average moviegoer. But on the other hand, it's also a movie that could completely not exist. And I don't think we lose anything in this universe. It's weird because it's perfectly enjoyable and fun. But I think by the end of the segment here, no one else is going to be talking about this movie. It's just not a event film. It does feel like they're desperately trying to reboot a franchise because Sony is like, we've got Spider-Man and Venom and that's it. I think it would have been better to go with their original idea of making a Men in Black movie that starred Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill from 21 Jump Street. I think that would have been a hilarious movie. But still, I mean, I'm going to say, even though it does nothing new and nothing groundbreaking and there's nothing terribly memorable about the movie, it's still a fun flick. I'm going to say Men in Black International kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about The Dead Don't Die. Jim Jarmusch directs this ZomCom about a small Pennsylvania town that faces a zombie outbreak.
This is really awful. Maybe the worst thing I've ever seen.
What was it, wild animals?
So what are you thinking?
I'm thinking zombies.
What?
You know, the undead. Ghouls.
You look gorgeous.
Flesh-eating zombies.
Don't joke, it's really, really creepy.
Oh, man, this isn't going to end well.
I remember when I first heard that Jim Jarmusch was going to be doing a zombie movie, I was not interested at all, because when he did his vampire movie, Only Lovers Left Alive, that thing was a bore. He goes way back, though. I think his stuff goes back into the mid to late 80s. When did Stranger Than Paradise come out? Late 80s, 88, 89. So that's about when he was really kicking around. And he's done genre movies before. You know, he did Dead Man, which was a Western. He did Ghost Dog, which was essentially an American black samurai movie. And yeah, he did Only Lovers Left Alive, which, while I didn't like it, arguably it fits in the genre movie, because it's, I wouldn't call it a horror movie as much as I would just say it's a vampire movie. You know, just because there are vampires in a movie doesn't mean it's a horror movie. If we learned anything from Twilight, that's one of the things we learned. But this one, I was kind of excited to see it when I found out it was a comedy. It's this dry wit comedy about these law enforcement officers trying to deal with this potential zombie outbreak. But then I started watching it, and while I really appreciated the slow pace, a non-intrusive camera movement, the style of independent cinema from the 90s, which is where Jarmusch really cut his teeth, I also looked at this movie and I said, well, it doesn't quite know what it wants to do, because it has these moments of breaking the fourth wall. I mean, like, exceedingly breaking the fourth wall, not just winking and nodding to the audience, but talking specifically about the movie within the movie. And while those are funny when they happen, it's inconsistent. And I found it a little jarring for just a joke. And the other problem with this movie is the dry stuff's fine, but at a certain point, you gotta do the zombie stuff. And it's almost like he made this movie, but he hates horror movies. And he's like, well, I never want to do a horror movie, and I want to do a zombie movie. I guess I'll do this, but I'm not going to take it seriously. He doesn't come with a love of the genre. And I mean, he may love them, I don't know, but I don't feel the love in this movie. Whereas if you look at like Shaun of the Dead, Edgar Wright's clear that Edgar Wright loves those kind of wicked zombie movies. And that's why Shaun of the Dead was so good. Same thing with Hot Fuzz. When Edgar Wright makes Hot Fuzz, it shows an absolute love for 80s and 90s action cop movies. Or go back to, you know, way back in the past, you know, when you watch Blazing Saddles, you totally get the sense that Mel Brooks had a love and affinity for Westerns. Same thing with Young Frankenstein. You could tell he had a real soft spot in his heart for the Universal Monster movies. I more feel disdain from the director in this movie, because it just feels like he doesn't take it seriously, and that he's kind of dumping on the genre itself while trying to make a movie within a genre. With everything from cheesing out on the special effects, and the zombie moments don't really work right, and they don't always make sense. And then there's this part of it that tries to become preachy and then literally overly explains everything about the movie, which I'm like, well, yeah, I get it. You don't have to hit us over the head with it unless you're really trying to talk down to the people who actually like zombie movies. So, yeah, I have some real mixed feelings about The Dead Don't Die, but ultimately I say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Late Night, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Frankenstein Created Woman. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We got one more movie to talk about as we roll into the final segment. And that movie is Late Night. Mindy Kaling writes and stars in the story of a comedian who becomes the only female in the writer's room for a late night comedy talk show.
That's our show, everyone.
I came to tell you this year is your last.
What?
They can't replace you if everyone loves you.
Do none of you understand what is at stake here? I am being replaced. Think about why the show is bad and come up with ways to fix it.
I know what everyone thinks of me, but just because I was lucky enough to get this job doesn't mean I'm stupid enough to lose it.
What exactly is wrong with my bits?
You're a little old and a little white.
What can I do about that?
I have some jokes for the monologue. I shouldn't do this in an English accent, should I?
First of all, I'm going to just let you know right now, I'm a huge fan of Mindy Kaling. I think she is fantastic. I think she's extremely funny. I think she has a great wit, and I think she really has what it takes to do the higher level organizational of writing and directing a film and running a show. You saw that with The Office. A lot of people don't realize this. She was very influential in The Office. Now, at the beginning, she came in, I think, in the second season as a staff writer, very similar to this, and she draws from her own experiences because apparently when she was in The Office, she was the only female in the writer's room. And not only that, she's a woman of color. So it's even more awkward and makes it harder to come up with the jokes in an honest fashion if you're trying to be politically correct or not be politically correct. But she ended up becoming a producer of the show and kind of running the show. Her and BJ Novak were very influential on the behind the scenes work of the show. As much as you might see, John Krasinski direct an episode, these were the people who kind of ran the show from behind the scenes. And even though her part was such a relatively minor part in the series. And then when she jumped into the Mindy Project, which I thought was a brilliant piece of work and extremely funny with some great characters and some great actors in it. And I recently pulled the trigger and got Hulu about 6 months ago on a special through like the Black Friday deal. And I've been catching up on some of the Mindy show, and that's still a great show. I mean, even though I think it ended up going through six seasons or something, but she's very funny and she's very fresh. There's no one quite like Mindy Kaling in Hollywood, and that's good, and that's a good brand. Now, she's not necessarily a great actor who plays outside of her role, and she's sometimes hard to cast simply because she just kind of brings that exuberant personality with her. So she ends up in stuff like Wrinkle in Time, kind of a goofy performance, or weirdly sidelined in Ocean's 8. But Late Night is a scathingly funny movie. It is extremely fun to watch. Not just for Mindy Kaling, but also for Emma Thompson, who plays the talk show host, who's a bit of a sexist in her own right because she doesn't want any women around because she kind of feels threatened by them, and has somebody who's almost exclusively always had a female boss in my life. You know, until then, you know, I had female bosses working when I was in middle school and high school and then outside of college. And then I got married and there's my boss for the rest of my life. So I understand what it's like to work for women. And I think she nails that as well, which I think is fantastic. I think she manages to balance the sexism and the anti-sexism in the same way with this and show how they can both be self-destructive. I think there's a certain degree of fantasy that goes along in this, that it's kind of manufactured to make it all work out. But that's okay. It's not a movie about whether or not it's a realistic beginning, middle, and end for a character. It's more a fun growth of this. And it is a whimsical, but still, it's nice to see good things happen to nice characters. And she does that. But it's a very funny movie. It's topical. And it manages to skirt along politics enough that it seems realistic because they are on essentially a Tonight Show type of set. So yeah, you're going to be dealing with politics, but to make them realistic politics, they're not necessarily preaching to people, but you know, look, let's put it this way. If you got a bunch of liberals in a writing room, they're going to have liberal jokes. There you go. That's what's going to happen. And that tends to happen in stand-up comedy, also in particular, like late night comedy. So I think this is a great movie and easily the best one that's out there this week in terms of new releases. I'm going to say Late Night totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the completely uninspiring box office from last week. It really was a dreadful box office. Like, not that they were like, it was dying, but everything just came in under. And I mean, it's still doing well. The box office in general is doing well because you've had some big movies, but the two big ones, which were The Secret Life of Pets 2 and Dark Phoenix, which are both franchise films, they both hit lows. The Secret Life of Pets 2 didn't even make half of what the first one made its opening weekend. And Dark Phoenix came in with like less than $33 million. That's the lowest any X-Men movie has ever opened. So whether or not they plan for this to be the last X-Men movie in that Fox run, it is the last X-Men movie. They're going to let it cool off for a couple of years, and then they're going to start putting those in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Mark my words on that one. Godzilla King of the Monsters dropped quite a bit. That's a shame. I'd like to see it do better, but it's doing absolutely fine overseas. I mean, these movies, these kaiju movies do very well overseas. It's a $300 million movie right now. So I wouldn't worry about holding a bake sale for them. Aladdin's surprisingly holding really well and also doing well overseas because sometimes international audiences don't care if Will Smith has to be the star of every single movie he does, even when he's not the star of the movie. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Frankenstein-created Woman. It is from Shout Factory, and it is from a 1966 or 1967 movie from Hammer Films. And it stars Peter Cushing as Baron Frankenstein, who brings to life a dead girl embodied with the spirit of her vengeful boyfriend.
Frankenstein's most terrifying experiment comes to life. Peter Cushing as Baron Frankenstein, who crosses swords with Satan in his fight for immortality.
He lives. See, hence he's alive.
The deformed creature transformed by Frankenstein to a living beauty. Within her, a dead man's revengeful urge to kill.
Kill him. Kill him. Kill him, Christina.
This is one of those Hammer films from the 60s that wasn't particularly gory. A lot of those old Hammer movies are known for being shocking and horrifying, but really all that stuff was subcontextual. And in this one, they have a couple decapitations in it, sure, but it's not a gory, violent movie. It has a couple deaths, but it's not like, it's not blood all over the screen. What's interesting about it is, like a lot of these movies, it's more sort of the taboo subject that they're covering. And yeah, Frankenstein had been around by this time in the films for 35 years, so there's nothing really new to contribute to Frankenstein. And they had already done a Bride of Frankenstein, so what they did is they twisted this up a little bit, and they made him, I don't know exactly how, it is kind of murkily explained in the movie, but somehow he took the body of a guy and somehow took his soul and put it into the dead body of his girlfriend, and she healed up because she was all deformed, and now she's beautiful, but she has the vengeance of him, and she has to go after all these people. And what's neat is it deals with this weird gender bending taboo topic that was certainly taboo back in the 60s. And it's only now really fully being discussed in a realistic fashion with, modern politics, but sort of the gender crossing here was really ahead of its time, and they don't make a big deal out of it. That's what I think is so fascinating about this movie, is that it's just thrown in there, and that's not the part that's shocking. It's the murders that are shocking and the beheadings that are shocking. It does have a bit of a slow burn. I mean, it's a fun movie and it's an interesting movie, and anything with Peter Cushing in it is always fun to watch. What's neat about him is he plays sort of that stock role of the stuffy professor. He's Baron Frankenstein, but he has no patience for anybody who doesn't understand his science. And so he just kind of snoots around through the whole film. Oh, I'm too good for this or whatever. It's really not about him. I mean, he plays a role in there. It's really more about the Frankenstein monster, which is a beautiful woman. And, you know, hey, I'd be willing to deal with a Frankenstein monster that's a beautiful woman any day, more than some rotting corpse. So overall, it's a fun movie. And if you like Hammer horror, if you love Peter Cushing, it's definitely worth checking out. It's on a collector's edition. There's a bunch of special features in it. It's got a couple interviews in there. It's the background of how to create the woman and the glamour that Hammer did, and the fact that Hammer would do stuff with women as sex objects. But of course, we're talking about late 60s sex objects from Britain. So it wasn't nearly as sexy as you'd think now. It has a look back at Peter Cushing, and it has a look back at The Curse of Frankenstein, which was the first Frankenstein that Hammer did, plus a bunch of the television spots and theatrical trailers, still image gallery and radio spots, all that good stuff. I'm going to have to say that this is fun, and that Frankenstein created Woman kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other releases this week include Captain Marvel and The Entity, which I talked about last week, the Star Trek Kelvin Timeline Trilogy, Ghostbusters 1 and 2, Leprechaun Returns, Piranha in Steelbook, Johnny Quest, the original complete animated series, and then new films, Captive State, 5 Feet Apart, and The Mustang. And that is it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Anna, Child's Play, and Toy Story 4. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.